focus.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll get an update on the continuing crisis in Sudan's western region of Darfur. It has been estimated that 2 million people have been driven from their homes and at least 180,000 have died there. The United Nations has described it as one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. This morning, we will review how this conflict started and also look at international efforts to end the fighting. And our guest for the program is Dr. Ali Alidinar. He is the Outreach Director of the African Studies Program at the University of Pennsylvania. He grew up in Sudan, was educated there and in the United States. He has a bachelor's degree from University of Khartoum in Sudan, a master's degree from the Institute of African and Asian Studies, and got his PhD at University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Folklore and Folk Life. He is now, as I say, the outreach director there. He has also been a lecturer at University of Pennsylvania and also instructor there at Penn at the Department of Folklore and Folk Life. And in addition to his teaching and responsibilities there, he has spent a lot of time over the last couple of years talking about the Sudan and about Darfur. He's been good enough to give us some time this morning, talk with us by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line, and that is good to anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. Even people listening on the internet can use that as long as they're in the United States. The toll-free line is 800-222-9455, and the local number for Champaign-Urbana listeners is 333-9455. Dr. Ali Dinar, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I think that it would be good for us again to review, do a basic overview of Darfur and of Sudan, even though it has gotten some coverage, at least, in the press that people might read. And I think that the conventional explanation, and I know from having talked to you before that perhaps it's a little more subtle than it's often described, but just specifically to talk about Darfur, here is a conflict that's been going on there now since early in 2003. There were rebels there in that area that felt that their interests were not being served by the government in Khartoum. And one of the conventional sort of ways it's explained is that with the long-running civil war between the North and the South getting close to a settlement and people in the North and the South agreeing how they're going to set up a government and particularly agreeing how they're going to allocate the natural wealth of the country, that people in the West, in Darfur, felt that they were completely cut out of the process and that perhaps the only way that they had to get the attention of the government was by using force of arms. Now, I have read that kind of explanation over and over again in articles about Darfur, and I think perhaps that's true as far as it goes, but does that really explain the roots of the conflict?
It's partially, and I think, the way you just describe it is correct, and to the extent that, the conflict in Darfur is now a spoiler to other kind of peace settlements in Sudan, and specifically with regard to the peace signed between the Sudanese government and the Mer Rebel Movement, the SPLM. To the extent that, now people could not, celebrate and see the good fruit of ending that conflict amicably, because we have another conflict in Darfur, and this conflict in Darfur is just distracting us from other things. And I think, in this case, the Sudanese government, the international community, they were very responsible of what's going on in Darfur, the way it's now being unfolding every day and every day. The Sudanese government, by its own action, by its involvement in the conflict right from the beginning up to now, and also by the international community for failing to understand the conflict in Darfur and also to genuinely evaluate the role of the Sudanese government in this and how it will make steps, serious steps, in bringing peace in that country rather than thinking that the Sudanese government will do it at some point when it will see the carrot.
The accusation against the government of Sudan has been that it used Arab militia, the Janjaweed militia that I'm sure people have heard about and read about, as a force, as a hammer, so to speak, to attack not only any rebels that might be active in Darfur, but what ended up happening is that they attacked everybody. They killed people. They killed women and children. They drove people out of their homes. They burned their homes down. Of course, the government of Sudan has said all along that they don't have anything to do, have no connection with the Janjaweed, which I think the international community feels is untrue. Yeah. Although perhaps there's also some question now about if the government was in control of the Janjaweed, have they in fact now lost control?
I don't think the government has lost control. I don't think it lost control over the main bodies behind the Janjaweed, their leaders and the military commanders, and is still in government-controlled areas and is still also under government payment. But definitely because the government, it just created a kind of a culture of banditry. To the extent for a lot of people, they just took the chance and went further in the hinterland, even beyond the reach of the government, and became a lifestyle. But this doesn't mean the government has no role, has no control, because like recently what we were seeing is that like a new kind of violence, not directed mainly towards villagers, but also for those internally displaced people in camps. And these camps were under all of them, under supervision and control of the NGOs, international NGOs. Even those people in camps, they were just being attacked, being harassed, women being raped, and all these kind of atrocities is still going on. And this is not like merely reported by the NGOs, but also like the AU force, which is now based in Darfur. Also, they report and they complain about the involvement and coordination between the Sudanese government army and the Janjaweed. So if we just think about the conflict in Darfur as the government just being arming a militia called the Janjaweed and let them set them free to go and attack non-Arab governments, I think like this is also part of the reality. Because the Sudanese army itself, it's directly, very directly involved, and it was aided in this by the Janjaweed. So the Janjaweed is just a new dimension of violence against civilians, which originally being orchestrated by the government itself.
So you would certainly say that there was no doubt that the government of Sudan had provided material and logistical assistance both to the Janjaweed. Did it go beyond that?
Yeah, I mean that is. I have no doubt that I have no doubt in my mind in that. I have been to Darfur in July 2004. I have been there. Just came from there also from in August. I was there August 2005. And Janjaweed were not early in the rural areas, but you could just see them who were now being retrained and being enlisted as troops in the Sudanese army, in Al-Fashir, in Darfur, in many urban centers. And they were there in a place in which they were supposed to protect civilians. But at the same time, also they are the original, they are the aggressors. But the government, in order to hide its act, and so it's implemented this option of absorbing it in its own force.
Something happened, and this was back in September, that seemed to be something the like of which had not happened before, and it seemed to be striking. And this was I believe in September 18th, when there was an attack by some Janjaweed on a police station.
Yeah.
And apparently the police were holding some Janjaweed there, and the others came, attacked the police station. They knocked the chief around, the police chief around, and took their members that were there in the jail. And it seemed to be for the Janjaweed now essentially to move against the government seemed to be a significant event. Was this just an isolated kind of event?
I think this could be just an isolated thing, because this happened in a place in Western Darfur, in a place called Geneena, in which like this thing took place. And I will not doubt like similar things could happen, but it is not like something which is extremely systematic to the extent that it will constitute a real threat to the government. That its hand, its link between it and the Janjaweed is now in a turmoil. Hmm. And I think also when you put this in perspective, it is not new. Because when we think about another place farther from Darfur, in which the government itself is just being implicated, for example, the LRA, the Lord Resistance Army in Uganda, which terrorized all the Ugandan in the northern part and also southern Sudanese. Because that LRA was made by the Sudanese government, it was funded by the Sudanese government, and it's still there is no control over it. It's still continuing its atrocities. It's very recently named by the International Criminal Court as people need to be prosecuted and wanted, and now they moved inside Zaire, and in that case, I mean, this is the. It was made by that government. There was no dispute between LRA when it was operative in the southern Sudan. There's no disputes between it or conflict between it and the Sudanese army. And I think the same thing also. You could just see it all here, between the Janjaweed and the Sudanese army, because the architects, the leaders of the Janjaweed, still they are benefiting from this kind of a relationship. And that kind of a relationship, they will let it go for a while because the government saying that it's not going to submit any person to the International Criminal Court. So that is like an assurance for them that they will be protected. And if you are a Janjaweed leader and benefiting from this whole situation, I don't see why you will cut that kind of a relationship with the government. Mm.
Yeah. Some of the comments that I have seen, particularly in some of the stories about this event, make it sound as if it wasn't bad enough, is that the situation in Darfur becomes more chaotic because we have more groups, more people with guns. For example, in a particular story, this is a story in the New York Times, quoted the head of the Peace Studies Institute at University of Khartoum, El Tayyab Haga Taya.
Mm-hmm.
I presume this is a man.
Yeah, I know him.
I thought you probably would. He says, Darfur is no longer under control. It's not just the government against the rebels anymore. There's this armed group and that armed group. It's getting more complicated by the day.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's a
I think also that is a true, but it is a situation of our own making. It's a situation of our own making. It's a situation in which we as the international community, we give credit and recognition to people who took arms, for example, you see, mm-hmm. regardless of whatever kind of agenda they have. This is, for example, with regard to the rebel movement in Darfur, because they are now, like every day you will hear about a splinter group. There were more than six peace negotiations in Abuja, in Nigeria, and in Chad, and nothing very substantively, like, at the hand. But the thing is that, like, we paraded, like, these groups as real representative of the people and of the region. And we think that, like, something good will come from this, you see. At the same time, also, we treated them in a level that what we expect from a real, well-trained, well-disciplined group. And this is also not true, because at some point also these splinter groups, when they fight among themselves, create a sense of insecurity, we treated them as if they were, we never expect such kind of a behavior to happen from them. And we put them like, maybe this is the reason why there is this chaos in Darfur. And I think the main chaos in Darfur is that, like, if really we want to put an end to it, I think, like, the Sudanese government have very enough troops, more troops than the AU or any troops from other region which could just come and provide security. But that never happened. So troops, I don't think, like, having troops in the ground is not the issue here. The issue here is the will to bring peace. We think that, like, just by providing the AU force of less than 7,000, that will bring peace in Darfur. And at the same time, also, we never talk that much that what is the mandate of this group. The mandate of the AU force is the protect of peace monitors and to observe ceasefire. It is not of one of its mandate to protect civilians. And that is why, since the arrival of the AU force in Darfur, violence against civilians is still continuing on under the eyes of the AU force. And we never talk about this. And I think, like, as an international community, this is our responsibility, because we provide the AU force with all the logistics, with all the money. But at the same time, also, we never talk about how to protect civilians. And I think that is the fallacy which I'm just seeing, like, unfolding. And that is why no one is just talking about those IDPs in camps or refugees who are continuously being attacked. We never hear about attack by the Sudanese government against a rebel movement or vice versa, but we always hear about attack against innocent civilians. And I think we never, up to this minute, we never address that issue genuinely and how we want to do that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Ali Dinar. He is the editor and outreach director at the African Studies Program at University of Pennsylvania, and for the last couple of years has done many interviews, has talked a lot about Darfur in the Western Sudan, and has been good enough to come spend some time here with us this morning, joining us by telephone. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number for people who are listening. If you have questions, toll free, 800-222-9455. As you mentioned, there have been talks going on. They're currently in adjournment. I think that they began maybe about 6 weeks ago in Nigeria, in Abuja, sponsored by the African Union. They're now in adjournment, and I think that they're due to resume again sometime later in November. Do you see some possibility that these talks will lead anywhere?
I don't think that possibility. I don't think that possibility. And in fact, like, in my two visits to Darfur and talking just to different people, observing things myself, I don't think, like, people there in Darfur, they were just relying that heavily on the outcome of these talks. Because one of the things is that, like, people know, like, the government is in an upper hand politically, militarily. The international community are more interested in ending this conflict in Darfur, not necessarily justly, but just to end that conflict, and at the same time also to tear to implementation of the peace agreement between the Sudanese government and the SPLM, and between the north and the south. So what we were just seeing up to this minute, there isn't anything which is very substantive to the people of Darfur, even me included, exactly what is the purpose, what are people going to achieve from all this, what's on the table. Neither the government nor the rebel movement, they just explain it themselves exactly what they want to achieve. And in that situation, people in the camps, they were still under the same kind of insecurity and harassment and no future. And people were mainly talking about division of wealth and power now, what people were just, this is between the rebel and the Sudanese government. And I don't see how that will just be translated to real questions or real answers to those who were lost everything. No one is just talking about reparation for them. No one talk about moving them back to their places. And no very serious steps in the ground to the extent that we let people voluntarily go back to their villages. It's just the opposite, you see. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of continuous harassment, continuous insecurity by the government itself. I don't think there would be real hope for people whose life was directly affected by this kind of violence, because they don't see it. So relying on kind of negotiation between these people who were having arms and the Sudanese government, I don't think that will just translate to real peace in the ground for them.
We have callers, and we'd like to bring them into the conversation. We'll start with Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see if the speaker could address the incident or the non-event that happened a couple of weeks ago when Bolton of the U.S. joined the Russians and the Chinese at the Security Council level in rejecting a planned report back from Darfur. I don't understand it. I mean, they don't seem to have traded away any, gotten anything from the Russians or Chinese. The investigation of the death of a billionaire in Lebanon seems to be so much more important than the death of thousands in Darfur.
Yeah, I mean, that is also, it's not something something new, because at some point, a lot of governments, they just think about their own national interests more than the human interests. And I think the case of Darfur, if you think about it like clearly, and how many people just, even in case of numbers, how many people just being affected, how long this conflict is just being dragging and on the air, and how resilient this conflict is when you compare it to other calamities in the world, like after the Darfur, whether of the tsunamis or whether of all these kind of hurricanes. I mean, the suffering of Darfurians is still continue. But there is also, what you could just sense that is that there is a lack of will, there is a lack of commitment to address the real issues here, real issues which will bring change, and it will bring peace to that region. Because the thing is that it's very complex, and being complex because of interests of some of the countries in the United in the UN, in the Security Council, because of dealings, whether it's the Russians or whether India, for example, or whether Algeria, which is also in the Security Council, and even the U.S. and the EU. And that is mainly between how not to get into conflict with the Sudanese government, and that was the problem, so that it will walk away from the peace which is just signed between it and the SPLM. That was, if we were going back into history, when this conflict just started. And I think that kind of a delay in sending that very strong signal to Sudanese government to desist from its act, I think now this is what we are like now reaping of, because things get very complicated now, and violence is just going in lot of directions, and not only that, but even the rebel group, which is supposed to protect the civilians, also it has its own issues among itself with all these divisions and so on. So the situation is just being chaos. And I think even within this chaos, people could just bring some kind of tranquility and peace if really the international community is willing to put more pressure on the Sudanese government.
I have an unrelated question, but on that point, do you imply that India also voted the same way as the U.S., Russia, and China? Is that what you implied?
Because there is also, like, because of the oil.
Uh-huh.
Because of the oil, India and Malaysia, because of arm deals from Russia and so on, because of China also is involved in the oil business in Sudan. So they were not like with sanctions. They are not like with severe measurements that will hamper the Sudanese government. Even the U.S. government, even with all the statements, for example, by the former Department of Secretary of State, Colin Powell, who was the first to describe what was happening in Darfur as a genocide, and with all the kind of financial aid being provided by the U.S. and so on, is still the position with regard to Darfur, I think it's a bit murky. You see, because you will hear some of the administrators, U.S. administrators, saying that like there is peace in Darfur, and just belittling the kind of violence which is now happening in Darfur, not going very aggressively against nowadays atrocities being committed against civilians in Darfur, but to the extent that like just belittling this kind of impact and going, even the United Nations representative also going too harsh against the rebel movement as if they were the cause of the problems. And for me, that is something which I just really expect the kind of divisions, the kind of splinter groups, which is now happening. Is not something new, and even for the people of Darfur also, that is not something new. But to make them as an scapegoat for the continuous violence which is being orchestrated by the Sudanese government is just like unacceptable. Because they were people who are extremely defenseless. And those people who are defenseless, they don't have a voice, people who speaking on their behalf, Sudan government attacking them. The rebel movement, although when they took arms, they say that we are going to bring peace and to bring justice to the region, but none of these concrete steps or concrete vision is now on the table so that people could just rally behind them.
On the unrelated point, if I might, oil and great power politics seems to be the reason for the impasse, but I've heard people argue that sort of something as global as climate change and diminishing resources on the ground of the expansion of the Sahara is actually one of the things that is actually driving the, you know, the dislocation and antagonism between these two groups that used to have a kind of a non-antagonistic, the farmers and the nomads.
Thank you. Yeah, that could be. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, that could be like a cause at some level and at some historical time, and that is not something new. Having tensions between people who are living in the same geographical area, but they have different lifestyle, mode of living, whether as farmers or whether as nomads, and due to climatic change or the encroachment of the desert in places, pushing people from their natural homes to places which is not like theirs, and that definitely could be a recipe of a conflict, and that was what was happening in what had happened in Darfur in the past, you will find these conflicts between people who were originally, for example, Arabs, or between people non-Arabs, or vice versa. And that is always happening. But what we are seeing here now these days is a different kind of a conflict. Because in the past conflict, always the government, the central government, is always neutral. What we are seeing here now is direct involvement of a government in aiding one group against another. So if we rely on the natural causes of a conflict, in this conflict in Darfur, which just erupted in 2003 as a result of this climatic changes, I don't see it as really the purpose, you see. Because this has been like for a long time, and in all this, the government, because it was impartial, and this impartiality is just helps some people to be more aggressive, and those were the people who at the end became part of the Janjaweed militias. And the other group were the victims, you see. And so this is what we were just seeing. But at the same time, also, I think like one of the points which people could just think about, we need to think about why the government, which ended civil war, which was the longest civil war in Africa, between the North and the South, it just ended it. And at the same time, while it's in the process of ending it, it started another war in another place, which I believe at that time when this violence erupted by this nature, it was controllable. Definitely it was controllable. But the government let it go and it added like more oil to the fire. And this thing is still going on. And I think we have always to ask ourselves a question. Because like providing civilians who are now in camps, just providing them with kind of security so that people could just live in peace in these camps or go back to their villages, I think this is a basic responsibility of the government. And the Sudanese government is not lack of resources, it's not lack of manpower. It has a huge army. Sudan is now an oil-exporting country. So I don't think because of lack of resources, but I think like because of lack of a will, you see. And that lack of a will, because I think this kind of war also maybe it's good with the government to continue this kind of violence which is just going on. I think in a way or another, it helps the government to stay longer in power.
We are a bit past our midpoint here. I have another caller I want to get to and also to introduce again our guest, Dr. Ali Dinar. He is editor and also outreach director of the African Studies Program at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about Sudan. And questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have that toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have another local caller here next up. That's someone in Urbana. Line number two.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Yes.
The whole Africa is such an interesting question because it sort of shows this these aspects of power politics and mixing those with the economic benefits to the wealthy, like in Darfur and in Sudan and all these places that have resources, or Congo or Zaire, whatever you used to call them. But when you were talking about the continuous nature of these wars, his internal strife and things like that. I was researching a book for 7th century Islam, and I ran across a Catholic papal pronouncement that Pelagius II gave Emperor Maurice, who was the emperor of the Byzantine Empire in the 7th century, like late 590, something like that. And he for solving, or actually assisting in a famine and civil disobedience in what was probably now Ethiopia. So, I mean, it's amazing that Africa seems to be such a basket case, and I mean southern Africa, you know, south of the Sudan, of the Sahara most likely, but it seems the indifference of the people in charge of like the UN and stuff, it's very disturbing that it just continues to go on and on, as if like they can just let these people, you know, the people in between, as you said, the victims of this, suffer immeasurably, and no one really cares. And it just really frustrates me to watch this and read about it. But
that is a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
The problem which I'm just always seeing is that, like, because because there are now thousands and thousands of aid officials in Darfur. There are millions and millions of millions of dollars being sent to Darfur. The rally behind Darfur cause, for example, in the U.S. mm-hmm. here, among students, among religious leaders, among just ordinary citizens, it's immense. I never seen such kind of a movement.
Mm-hmm.
To aid a group like this. And all people here, they were not just talking about the solving the Darfur problem politically, but were merely being touched by the suffering of the people.
Yeah.
And that kind of suffering of the people is supposed to be the focus,
mm-hmm.
not only the focus of us as citizens, but also the focus of our government and all the UN and other NGOs.
Yeah.
And when we were I'm just seeing about that, like being to these places here, you see that, like, there's people just being uprooted. They were in refugee camps, several refugee camps. They were there, given shelter, given kind of food, a kind of a subsistence that will keep them alive, you see.
Yeah.
And that's it. And even now, attack against what was remain of villages, attacks now against even those people in refugee camps, is still continuing on.
Yeah.
And continuing on, not necessarily by the rebel group still chasing those people, but by the Sudanese army. Because, like, when we say, because this issue is in Sudan, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely Sudanese government has a presence, you see.
Yeah.
Because even, like, for aid agencies to go, they have to have clearance. They have to get visas, you see, because they have to be allowed to work in Sudan.
Yeah,
so we cannot, like, just dismiss Sudan. It's not like a country in which, like, you could just take your bag and say, okay, I have in my bag 5,000, I'm going to go and save the people of Darfur. No, because you have to go in these channels. So the state has a responsibility.
Yeah, and as you said earlier, the state is complicit in this. And that's what makes it so difficult, because I know NGOs, I know some people that have worked in these over the years, and they say that if you don't have the consent or the support of the government, you might as well leave, because, you know, and what really bothers me and continues to bother me is the fact that, as you so rightly point out, the people in the middle of this mess are the ones who are dying in droves, and they all they want to be is left alone, and no one wants to leave them alone.
Exactly.
And it's sort of like, I mean, we talk about democracies and all these, you know, oppressive countries, and these people can't live any kind of life. They're just like fodder for whatever machinations whoever wants to think of what. And I really appreciate all your work.
Yeah, thank
I really
you.
Do. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Just like another follow up is that, like, you could just see the contrast between all our involvement, all our hope for people about this peace negotiation. Because I don't think, like, this peace negotiation, people in Darfur who are just these in camps, they are turning to their radios and trying to listen what is going on, what is happening, or what will happen, you see. People are not talking about that. People are just thinking about now in the ground, and I think, like, this is at the reach of the government, what will happen, you see. And I think that is also a trap for the international community, putting a lot of emphasis, putting a lot of hope that, like, reaching whatever kind of a peace deal, you see, which I'm just, like, not very optimistic about it, any kind of a peace deal between the Sudanese government and those rebel groups that will bring peace or will change the situation in Darfur. That will just be a blanket that would just be a blanket. But the kind of problems, the kind of issues which now being in Darfur, the situation here between the rift which happened between people who were just living in the same geographical areas and now with severe kind of animosity and hatred between groups who were now victims and people who were aggressors, having all the arm, having all the backing of the state, and nothing, no one is just talking about it. Like the Sudanese government is not just talking about it. The international community, they were not just hammering on this kind of reconciliation and peace, establishment of peace in Darfur, regardless of what is going to happen in Abuja, because like now they postpone it that they will meet again in November, and the some official saying that before the end of this year we will reach an agreement, as if reaching an agreement that will just solve the crisis in Sudan, and I don't see that that will solve the crisis for the people in Darfur. Just signing that kind of a peace, even if it is now, because the culture of violence. The that kind of a belief in just doing much of a harm against an innocent civilian is still continuous, you see. And the government is not like doing its homework in changing that situation. It is still in the state of denial and is still seeing this whole thing as Western propaganda to discredit it. And at the same time, also, it wants to reap from it by signing that peace agreement between it and the SPLM, in which got like more than $4-6 billion being donated for the reconstruction of the North and the South. So it was just talking about that, like.
Let me ask you, just because you did say that one of the reasons that the international community was reluctant to put pressure on the government in Khartoum was that there had been finally, just at the end of last year, a tentative agreement reached to end this long, 21-year-long, longest-running civil war in Africa between the government and the SPLM.
Yeah.
And that the concern was you didn't want to do anything that would upset the government of Sudan and then have them walk away from this peace process, which is still very, very tentative. So then I guess my question is, at this point, mm-hmm. when you talk about the settlement of the North-South conflict, mm-hmm. is it really still that fragile? Would trying to put some pressure on the government in Khartoum, would speaking to them very strongly about the fact that they more than anybody else would be in the best position to stop the conflict in Darfur, would that really be likely to collapse this tentative agreement between the North and the South that ended the long war?
No, I don't think that that agreement will collapse, you see. I don't think that agreement will collapse, because that agreement, I think, it for the benefit of these two groups. I mean, unfortunately, the architect, the main leader behind this whole thing, the leader of the SPLM, the person who a lot of people, especially from the marginalized areas and non-marginalized areas, they look at him as the real leader, as the hope for Sudan. Dr. John Garang, he just died in a car crash 3 weeks after he came to Khartoum. That was a big blow, you see, to people who were thinking that Sudan will be in a right path, in a right track. This comprehensive peace agreement, which was signed between the government and the SPLM, could lead away, and it will affect and bring peace and stability, not only in the South, but also in Darfur and in Sudan in general. That hope just dashed away that day. And since his death, what we were just seeing now in the political arena in Sudan, in the Sudanese politics, is that nothing changed. Nothing changed. Starting from the formation of the, what they call it, the national unity government, in which the Sudanese government, the national, the Sudanese government, which they have all the key ministerial jobs were kept by them. All the hardliners of the regime were having the key ministerial jobs. And what's left for the people from the south and other areas is just like very marginal ministerial jobs, which in the Sudanese politics is very indicative, which means that the Sudanese government is not willing to share power with other groups equally, you see. We don't see any kind of change in Darfur in terms of kind of violence being orchestrated by the state there. It's just the opposite. It's just the rise, you see. So that kind of a hope, like this peace agreement will just result and it will just radiate to peace for other places in Sudan, I think that dashed out. That dashed out. People are not like very hopeful. But at the same time, because this is an international agreement, I think the Sudanese government is bound to that agreement. But it will create a lot of problems in terms of timing, because like it has a timetable in which like a lot of issues it has to be implemented at a specific time, and I think that was not happening. So I think like there could be some kind of a delay, but complete negation of the whole agreement, I don't see that will happen. And, but at the same time, also, I don't see it will result positively in spreading a kind of peace and hope to places which are now affected by war in Sudan.
Let me ask you this: I have read some stories about the fact that there has been some fighting, some rebel activity in the eastern part.
Yeah,
Sudan, in the area that borders on Eritrea,
yeah.
And that there is some concern there that rebels there, that the government would see rebel activity there as another threat to their power, and that could the government sponsor similar militias there, and we could have a situation in the east, that something like what we have seen now in the west, in Darfur.
Yeah, I mean, that was also... That kind of activity also, it was just being launched for a long while. I mean, it was on and off. The kind of dissatisfaction by the central government policies to this region and these groups in the east, it's also not common. It's being there for a long time.
Mm.
And I just see it also as another indicative of what we sign on as a comprehensive peace agreement between the Sudan government and the SPLM, which we think that this will be a formula ending the war in the north and in the south, and at the same time also could be implemented in other places in Sudan. I don't think that is working, because the government is not willing to use that, is not willing to give in, is not willing to share power with groups, is not willing to share wealth with groups, and that is why what we are seeing now is this kind of continuation, and as if nothing happened, as if nothing changed. So this rebel movement in the east is not new. I mean, I could just see maybe another rebel group in another part also. In the Sudan, which may come at any time.
We'll see if we can get we have one caller here, and get a very quick comment because we're almost out of time. We have a caller in Charleston. This is line four. Hello.
Yes, very short, David. How many people, what's the population of Africa overall, including Egypt?
Including Africa?
Africa?
Around 800 million.
How many?
800 million.
100 million.
800.
800.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah,
approaching a billion people.
Exactly.
What's going to happen? I think in 50 years, the Chinese model will be used in Africa, where there is a huge mass.
Yeah.
Of cheap labor. Then the focus will shift to Africa, and then what we've seen in China has taken 50 years for those people to rise to the top, labor-wise, and I see that same thing happening in all of Africa, and unified under a common government, and then there's the labor ready and waiting to be exploited. And thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, we're almost at the point where we have to stop. I guess the picture here, in at least over the short term, not particularly optimistic.
Yes.
Is there any reason to be hopeful? Specifically, I'm talking specifically about Sudan and about Darfur.
Yeah. I will only be hopeful if there is a twist and there is a change in our rhetoric and our priorities of what is the main purpose for us towards innocent civilians. And I think unless I see that just being changed to put it on the primary focus, I'm not talking about issues about our relationship with the government and about economic investment and oil investment and so on, I think that that will not bring peace and tranquility in Darfur and in other places in Africa and in the world. I think we have to put to think about steps which will bring peace and justice in for those who are being affected.
There we will have to stop. And our guest is Dr. Ali Dinar. He is Outreach Director of the African Studies Program at University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. Ali Dinar, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The broadcast today made possible with support from the U of I Office of the Chancellor, supporting the campus charitable fund drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at ccfd.uiuc.edu. The broadcast is also made possible by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. We're going to break, as we usually do. We'll have news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First